Hello and welcome to Revision here on RN, Radio Australia and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince and today the story of a very special relationship.
In the Oval Office, President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu
strive. The United States will always have Israel's back when it comes to Israel's security. The bond between our two countries is unbreakable.
Israel and the United States share common values. We face common enemies. Iran's leaders know that too.
There's no debate that the United States has a special relationship with Israel. It's existed for decades and has arguably defined the United States' foreign policy in the Middle East. So how and why has this special relationship developed? And what impact has it had on Middle East politics? The story of the special relationship is complex, but let's begin in 1948.
Soviet Union, yes. United Kingdom, abstain. The United States, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine.
At the end of World War II, a world shocked by the horrors of the Holocaust supported a resolution in the newly formed United Nations to divide the British mandate for Palestine in two, creating a Jewish and an Arab state. While the resolution was officially supported by the US government, the Truman administration was divided over the wisdom of establishing a Jewish state in the Middle East. Some officials feared that US support for an Israeli state would aggravate the Arabs and undermine US interests in the region.
Truman, who was inclined not to recognize Israel, nevertheless did recognize Israel. And the principal reason that he did it was for domestic political reason.
John Mearsheimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago.
He felt that if he supported Israel, he would get money from prominent Jews that would help him in his election campaign in 1948. And furthermore, he knew that if he recognized the State of Israel, that he would get lots of Jewish votes and that that would help him stay in the White House. And of course, he did stay in the White House. He won a close election that fall. So you basically had a situation in May 1948 where strategic considerations said, don't recognize the new State of Israel, but domestic political considerations in the United States said, recognize the State of Israel. So Truman went with domestic politics over strategic calculations.
President Truman did recognize Israel just minutes after the Zionist leaders in Jerusalem declared the existence of the state and giving Israel a very profound degree of national legitimacy.
Professor of History at Ohio State University, Peter Hahn.
The Zionist leaders were appreciative of the American recognition, but then they desperately requested that the United States send weapons and money so that they could have the means to survive, the means to defend themselves. And Truman declined those requests. And through the summer of 1948, again, as the Israeli people fought for their very lives, fought for the existence of their newborn state, Truman took a very hands-off approach. And the Israelis were resentful that the United States had failed to back them.
The bureaucracy, particularly the Pentagon, was very worried or concerned about the sort of socialist nature of the Israeli elite. The Jewish leadership was composed of left-wing political parties, quite committed to, not to communism, but sort of left-wing ideology.
Abraham Ben-Zvi, Professor of Political Science at the University of Haifa.
At the time, by the way, the Soviet Union supported Israel out of purely instrumental considerations because Israel was useful in driving the British out of the Middle East. So there was illusions that an alliance would be forged between the Soviet Union and Israel. Of course, it was not practical and Stalin was totally anti-Semitic. But still, the Pentagon looked upon Israel as a strategic liability. These were very chilly or very cold and detached years.
Another factor to mention is that the early Israeli government, the first government of David Ben-Gurion, calculated that it could best preserve the interests of the state by adopting a neutralist position in the Cold War. And so from 1948 until about 1951, Israel did not side with the United States on matters pertaining to the Cold War. Now that sort of relatively quickly came to an end by the early 1950s. During the Korean War, Truman said to the Israelis, you're either for us or you're against us. Ben-Gurion kind of understood that the time had arrived for him to lead his country from neutralism toward a pro-Western orientation. And he did so. He implicitly endorsed the international effort in Korea. He began to give other political signals through votes at the UN and other such measures that his country was a member of the so-called free world.
July the 26th, 1956. NASA nationalizes the Suez Canal Company.
There's no question that the United States was able to apply a significant amount of pressure on Israel during the 1956 crisis. What happened there was that Israel, working together with Britain and France, went to war against Egypt. This was done behind Eisenhower's back, and the president was enraged. The Israelis, in the course of that war, had conquered the Sinai Peninsula, and David Ben-Gurion, who was then the prime minister, wanted to hang on to the Sinai Peninsula and not give it back to Egypt. But Eisenhower told him that under no circumstances was that acceptable, and he forced Ben-Gurion to give it back. This is one of the few instances in the history of relations between the United States and Israel where an American president leaned heavily on Israel and, in effect, coerced it into changing its behavior. And I think if you look carefully at how Truman acted towards Israel between 1948 and 1953, and how Eisenhower acted towards Israel in the 1950s, you see that in those days, there was no special relationship between the two countries, and the United States treated Israel like a normal country. That all began to change, of course, in the early 1960s, starting with President Kennedy.
I think that at that time, the United States was busy in containing Soviet penetration into the region.
Eitan Gilboa, professor of politics and communication at Bar-Ilan University in Israel.
The U.S. solution to the Soviet threat was to establish regional alliances based primarily on the pro-West Arab countries. And the U.S. felt that the Arab-Israeli conflict was preventing a successful establishment of the regional Arab alliances. So during the Eisenhower administration, Israel was considered as a burden on U.S. overall global and regional strategy. Only during the beginning of the Kennedy administration, in the early 60s, this view has changed, because the Soviet Union wanted to establish an alliance for itself with countries such as Egypt and Syria. Also, during the Kennedy administration, the U.S. came to evaluate the importance of Israel military strength. And immediately after the 1967 war, the U.S. perceived Israel to be an important ally in the battle against Soviet allies in the Middle East.
A small, outnumbered people facing the threat of annihilation rose and fought for its existence. The Jewish people throughout the world united as never before around beleaguered Israel.
The decisive moment in 1967 was the so-called Six-Day War, the Arab-Israeli War of June 1967. That was crucial because the American Jewish community especially rallied to the cause of defending Israel, because early in the wartime period, there was a sense that Israel was facing a moment of potential national extinction. And when Israel averted that potential outcome with its preemptive strike against Egypt and Jordan and Syria and won the war in very dramatic fashion, it sort of became the big man on campus. And so Israeli philia sort of swept the United States, people of all classes and cultures and religion, and Israel became a darling in American public opinion.
You're with Revision on RN, RA and via the web. I'm Annabel Quince, and today we're taking a look at the special relationship the United States has with Israel. While strategic considerations were clearly important to the relationship, according to John Mearsheimer, other factors were also important.
First of all, I think starting in the mid-1960s, large numbers of American Jews are beginning to become very successful. They're now very comfortably ensconced in the mainstream. It's important to remember that the vast majority of American Jews who came from Europe came between 1890 and 1924, and it took quite a while for them, like all other immigrant groups, to assimilate into the mainstream. Second thing that happens is that because of the decline of religion in the American Jewish community, Israel becomes very important in the daily life of synagogues and Jewish organizations all around the country. Then I think the final reason that you see the special relationship developing in the late 60s and early 70s is because President Nixon and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, decide that Israel can be a useful ally in waging the Cold War against the Soviet Union. After the 1967 war, where Israel defeated the Syrians, the Egyptians, and the Jordanians, the Americans came to conclude that this country, Israel, might be an effective ally at beating up on Soviet client states in the region. So for strategic reasons, the Nixon administration took a giant step towards forming a special relationship with Israel. And as I say, this factor has to be married with the fact that large numbers of American Jews were successfully assimilated by this point, and also because Israel and the Holocaust were so important in daily Jewish life.
I'm just wondering, in that period when you say that that sort of affection for Israel started to sweep through the United States, is that where we begin to see the sort of the genesis of what I guess we'd call today the Israeli lobby in the United States?
The genesis of the Israeli lobby goes all the way back to the genesis of the Israeli state. The Israeli government had representation in the United States, not only in Washington at its embassy to the U.S. government, but also in New York at its embassy to the United Nations. And the staff of those two embassies was very astute, very observant about political trends within America. They were very cognizant that the State Department, Defense Department, and CIA were unfriendly, if not hostile. They were also very cognizant that there were seeds of pro-Israeli sentiment deeply planted on Capitol Hill. And the records of those embassies, which are open to public inspection at the Israel State Archive in Jerusalem, make clear that those officials realized that there was going to be an enormous battle for the mind of President Truman, and that it was their duty as Israeli government officials to try to shape the outcome of that debate by encouraging pro-Israel sentiment on the streets of America and by encouraging pro-Israeli statements and votes on Capitol Hill. The idea was they needed to have a public information campaign to generate or to encourage the growth of the innate pro-Israeli sentiment among the American people. And they had a very long list of initiatives, from contacting labor leaders to contacting leaders of churches to writing letters to publishing pamphlets, working with Hollywood movie makers to make films. Eventually, they got into complicated businesses like planting chairs of Jewish studies at East Coast universities, all kinds of initiatives taken to try to build a popular disposition in favor of Israel. That laid the groundwork then for the emergence of what we call the Israeli lobby.
The first point I would make is that the lobby is a loose coalition of individuals and groups that work actively to push U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. There's no central organization. There are no membership cards. It's a loose coalition. Now, sometimes people refer to the lobby as the Jewish lobby. This is a mistake. Not all American Jews could be considered part of the lobby. And furthermore, the lobby includes large numbers of non-Jews, especially Christian Zionists, who are deeply committed to Israel and in many ways are more committed than many Jews in the United States to pushing the U.S. government in a pro-Israel direction. So it's these non-Jews coupled with the Jews in America who really care greatly about Israel who comprise the heart and soul of the lobby.
Everybody who knows how the American system works understands that lobby groups in the United States are legitimate. It's not something that is illegitimate, because the enemies of Israel frequently say, oh, all American-Israeli relations could be explained by the strength of the Israeli lobby. This is not true, but also, if it had been the case, this is legitimate in the American political system. A lobby group in the United States must have strong grounding and support in public opinion. And because there is very strong support for Israel in American public opinion, the pro-Israel lobby is able to translate this support into political power. I want to emphasize, however, that there is also a very strong pro-Arab lobby in the United States. The two lobby groups are often competing. It is a significant factor, but my argument is that if American-Israeli relations had been relying just on the power of the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington, the relations would not have been that close. Other factors, such as the value system that combine the two countries and strategic interests, are far more important than the power of the lobby.
Well, the first general point I would make is that it is very important to understand that interest groups wield enormous influence in American politics. It means that a well-organized group of people, whether you're talking about the National Rifle Association or the Israel lobby or the Cuban lobby, is going to be operating in an environment where it should be able to punch well above its weight. Now, getting to the specifics of the Israel lobby, why does this particular lobby do so well at getting aid for Israel and influencing U.S. Middle East policy in ways that work to Israel's benefit? First of all, the people who run these organizations are very smart and very good at getting what they want. Also important to emphasize that they have no opposition. There's no Palestinian lobby. There's no meaningful Arab lobby. Now, to be even more specific, a lot of the lobby's power comes from money. Everybody in this country who runs for Congress or runs for the president understands full well that it would be a huge mistake to cross the lobby, because not only would you not get any money from organizations in the lobby, but your opponent would get lots of money, and that would not be good. So money is a very important source of power. Votes also matter. American Jews are probably about 2% of the population, but their turnout on election day is very high, and they're located in a number of very important states. Just take Florida, for example. In the 2000 presidential election, it all came down to a handful of votes in Florida. Well, Florida has a large number of Jews. It also, by the way, has a large number of Cuban Americans. That means that any presidential candidate wants to make sure that he or she does not alienate either those American Jews or those Cuban Americans in Florida. So votes also matter. It's also important to recognize that supporters of Israel have great influence in the American media. The Wall Street Journal, Fox News, The Washington Post, these are media outlets that are effectively in a position where they defend Israel at almost every turn. And that, coupled with all those factors, allows the lobby to be very powerful.
One of the key aspects of the special relationship is the amount of aid, both financial and military, that the U.S. gives Israel.
It's about $3 billion per year for economic aid, and maybe a slightly smaller additional amount under the category of military assistance.
How does that compare to U.S. aid that's gone to other places?
I think U.S. aid globally is about $45 billion a year, so about $1 of every 15 is directed toward Israel. For a long time, Israel was the world's greatest recipient of U.S. aid. Egypt was given aid for the same purpose, although the amount that ended up in Egyptian hands was always slightly less than the amount that ended up in Israeli hands.
And was that aid significant, do you think, in Israel's survival?
Yes, because Israel is a small country surrounded by an ocean of hostile Arab enemies. The United States did not want Israel to depend on American military intervention, the basic solution would be to equip Israel with sufficient number of weapons of high quality so that it can defend itself against any threat.
Has the special relationship given U.S. presidents any special influence on Israel's policy decisions?
Well, American presidents have had remarkably little influence on Israeli policy. The most important example of that is the settlements. Israel captured the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967, and shortly thereafter, it began colonizing those two pieces of territory. Every American president since 1967 has opposed the building of settlements in the occupied territories. Every president has understood that it is morally wrong, legally wrong, and not in the strategic interests of the United States. Nevertheless, no president has been able to stop the Israelis from building settlements. So this is just one example of where the Americans have had hardly any influence on one of Israel's most important policies. I could point to others as well.
There are certain strategic issues where Israel says we would like to accommodate American wishes and requests. But when it comes to those kind of interests, sometimes we have to say no. I don't think that the settlements issue has created the kind of tension that many people suggest exists between the two countries. Many have argued that the settlement issue prevents conflict resolution and peace. This has been, to some extent, the American position. But if you look at reality, it's a different story. One, because Israel proved that if it comes to a peace agreement, such as the one with Egypt, it withdraws and dismantles settlements.
What happens post the collapse of the Soviet Union? Because clearly the Cold War was very significant in forging that relationship between Israel and the United States. So with the end of the Cold War, in some ways you would have suspected that that relationship might have become much more difficult.
Right. During the Reagan administration, for example, Israel was really perceived as a major asset in the Cold War, particularly in the Eastern Mediterranean. So one could expect a diminution of Israel's importance because some of its military services were not needed any longer when the context shifted. But I don't think that there was any diminution. The 80s were probably the peak of strategic collaboration. Perhaps now we can see another era. But one could expect in the 90s erosion, right, of the strategic ties. It didn't happen because all the priorities shifted, but with the threat of international terrorism becoming dominant, Israel had another role to play. Yes, it was a different agenda, not any longer a containment of the Soviet Union, but Israel's importance became sort of manifested when it became a partner in the war against radicalism, against low-intensity conflicts, particularly, you know, Al-Qaeda and radical Islam. So the focus shifted, but there was some shared vision of threat, radicalism and terror. So you have it particularly, obviously, during the Bush era in a most dramatic way.
Our second goal is to prevent regimes that sponsor terror. North Korea is a regime arming with missiles and weapons of mass destruction. Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror. Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil.
There is no question that as a result of the 1979 revolution in Iran and the subsequent hostage crisis, that the United States had bad relations with Iran. However, the Iranians were very interested at different points in the 1990s and even in the 2000s in trying to improve relations with the United States. And the United States itself was interested in improving its relations with Iran. But this never happened. And the main reason is that Israel was deeply committed after the collapse of the Soviet Union to making Iran the bogeyman for the United States and for Israel in the Middle East. the Israelis understood that in the absence of the Soviet Union, there was no strategic need for a special relationship. So what was needed was to create a threat, a common threat. I think the Israelis concluded in the early 90s that Iran was that threat. And since the early 1990s, the Israelis have worked overtime to portray Iran as the second coming of the Third Reich and to make the argument that the United States cannot engage in diplomacy with Iran. And of course, there's all sorts of evidence that that's what's happening today with regard to the Iranian nuclear program.
I don't buy that argument. I think that since the Islamic fundamentalist revolution in Iran in 1978-79, Iran declared war on the United States, defined the United States as the big Satan. Iran wants to export its brand of extreme Islamist revolution to the entire Middle East. They want to replace all the governments in the region and establish governments of their own kind. They want to control all the oil resources of the Middle East. This is why a combination of nuclear Iran with the extremist ideology, support for terrorism in the entire world, is very dangerous. And this is why there is almost a unanimous agreement in the world that Iran should be prevented from acquiring nuclear weapons.
First of all, the special relationship is what makes it possible for Israel to reject a two-state solution and to continue building settlements. Furthermore, the special relationship has created this situation where it's almost impossible for us to reach a negotiated settlement with the Iranians. And instead, we seem to be hurling down a road to war against Iran. My view is that the special relationship is a disaster for the United States, and it would make much more sense if the United States treated Israel like a normal country.
In the United States, public opinion is a major factor, and the public extensive and stable support for Israel over time is clearly reflected in Congress. And I believe that this is really the foundation of the U.S.-Israeli relations and why the two countries have been able to develop and maintain a very close special relationship.
The main gain of the special relationship has been the preservation of a democratic, capitalist, and friendly state in the heartland of the Middle East. Defenders of Israel today will openly and with great pride talk about how proud they are that the United States assisted in the survival of the Middle East's only democracy. By proxy, the United States is projecting a foreign policy that results in the survival of countries that share American values and seem to represent the Western way of life. Now, detractors, of course, will say that's fine, but the residual disadvantages of having aggravated tension and alienated other populations in the region, that's the cost of the special relationship. And that's part of the discussion that goes on in public discourse, the balance sheet question, whether the advantages or the disadvantages carry the most weight.
In today's program, we've heard from four academics. From America, Peter Hahn and John Mearsheimer. From Israel, Eitan Gilboa and Abraham Ben-Zvi. Phil McKellar is the sound engineer. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN. Thanks for joining us.